My name is Amy Freed, and I'm in Helen C. White Hall. The date is June 18th, 1987, and I'm interviewing Dr. Edwin Young.
Why don't we just pass it back and forth? Okay.
I know that you've had a long and distinguished career with the university, and I wanted to concentrate, though, on your connection with the Industrial Relations Institute and the study of industrial relations. And I wanted to start by just asking you to describe your connection with the Institute and the Department of Economics, how you came to the University of Wisconsin, and some of the early quote-unquote movers and shakers in the field who you had some connection with.
Yes, I learned about the Institute from the beginning. Around 1947 or 48, Professors Feinsinger and Witte were leading people in the field of industrial relations at Wisconsin. Decided that there should be an institute or a center for industrial relations where both labor and management problems were studied and joint meetings were arranged, etc., and research carried on. This was in vogue around the country. A number of such institutes or organizations were being organized. And so they set up an organization, and Robin Fleming was invited to come from Washington. Robin Fleming had been a graduate in law school here, and had, after the war, had gone and was working in Washington. He invited him to come back as the director of it, and almost the only staff person. Perhaps he had a secretary, and he set about arranging seminars and getting papers written. But he ran into a good deal of difficulty. He didn't get the cooperation of the Manufacturers Association nor of the dean of the business school. The Manufacturers Association's position was, even though they may not have stated it publicly, but it was clear that they didn't want their people to appear on the same platforms with trade unionists. Many of the members, or more vocal ones particularly, were anti-union, open shop people, whatever you call them, and they didn't want to give credence to unionism. And this is, you're getting my view of the way things were. Mm-hmm. Fleming worked very hard, traveled around, got to know many employers, and was on good terms with them. He was on good terms with labor people. I think it would be a mistake to go on without calling him up and talking with him on the phone, at least. I've got his phone numbers. Mm-hmm. He's now retired as president of the University of Michigan. After 2 or 3 years of trying, Bob accepted another position as director of the Industrial Relations Center at Illinois, where there was lots of money for research, where they had cooperation from management and labor in a way we didn't have in Wisconsin. I was asked to be sort of a caretaker of the Institute so that it wouldn't die. And we carried on, we reorganized it somewhat and kept it alive. During that period, we didn't accomplish a great deal. I was busy. I was first a school for workers and then as chairman of the department. But at least we kept the program going. Then in 55, 56, I spent the academic year in Brussels, where the International Labor Organizations were located, and Professor Reed Tripp became the director of the Institute. While I was gone, a decision which had been much discussed before I went, to offer degree courses for in a degree program, that decision was taken. I had argued against it, but in hindsight, it was the right decision. I was eager to keep labor activities in the Department of Economics, where it had been for a long time, and I was worried about the Institute drawing that away. So what had started out as a program dealing with industry and labor became increasingly a research and teaching program, and that evolved over a number of years. Professor Tripp gave it good leadership, and the number of people involved increased. We had to feel our way along. At times, once in a while, some person would join who looked upon it as a device for giving his own degree outside of his own department. We had to tighten up the rules and so on. If you read the minutes, you'll discover some of these things. But my role wasn't a tremendously important one. I worked at it. I participated, and I kept the thing alive in a very difficult time. And later on, as dean, I was able to support it with some funding and so on. But my role was not, I made no great innovations. My problem was to keep something going while I was juggling the very tricky business in the department at that time. The department was much more important in my life than the Institute.
So you were department chair of economics at the same time that you had the directorship of the
yes.
of the Institute.
Not exactly, but they overlapped. They mm-hmm. weren't identical. There were some of those years, but in the records you can get the dates right. I don't remember them exactly, mm-hmm. but I remember being a very busy young man. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to take up the sort of the development you said from a source of a sort of meeting ground between labor and management, which the Institute was originally, to an institution more devoted to research and teaching. If you could describe that a little bit.
Well, I think the development came about the transition because what Bob Fleming had been trying to do was so difficult, and there was a crying need for a teaching program, an interdisciplinary one. And furthermore, as the department changed, and it went through very great changes in those years. Those are the years when people such as Perlman, Witte, Les Cohere, Brandeis were retiring, and the department was moving in a more theoretical, more mathematical direction, and so that some of the trends in industrial relations involved more work in psychology, more work in business management, and a lot of other things. So it was something that was bound to come. It came a little sooner than I would have argued for, but as I said before, I was wrong. But that's the reason it came about. It filled a vacuum that was there. And one of the very important things that happened was we were able to recruit Jerry Summers to the economics department, and he provided a lot of leadership. He died at an early age some years ago, but he played a big role.
You mentioned that there was opposition to the program from the School of Commerce, I guess as it was called at the time.
Yes.
And, I mean, what form did that take, and if you want to name names, you know?
Well, the business school, in the time of, we call it School of Commerce those days, now called the business school, Mr. Elwell didn't want any cooperation. He opposition, but just not doing it. He didn't have to do anything. He just not cooperate. He was a very conservative person. His friends in the business community tended to be quite conservative, and he was well established, and I think it's fair to say that he regarded his role almost as defending the business school, the commerce school, against the rest of the university. Because when it came about in the first place, when it was created, separate, cut off from letters and science, the faculty had voted against it, but the regents had done it anyway, so he regarded himself as being a little beleaguered. He considered many people in the economics department as radicals. One day, someone came in and told me he had referred to those communists down in the economics department. So I immediately marched upstairs and marched into his office and pounded the table and had him told him to put up or shut up. Well, he wasn't used to having young whippersnappers do that. I quieted him down. Yes, he had to be called. He was his views about things. The other hand, he was a very able man, and he had one of the strongest accounting programs at the time in the country. But he ran the business school, and he had got into. He'd given up his graduate work in World War I to teach in order to keep the place going, and never did get an advanced degree, which I think bothered him somewhat. But he was able, but he trade unionism wasn't his thing.
Can you talk a little bit more about your dealings with I don't know if Commons was still alive when you came, but I guess Perlman. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere in the records about Commons Friday nights or something, and whether that was still going on even after his death, or some of the student associates that were still there at the time.
I never met Mr. Commons. He died, I think, in 1942. He'd left here before that to go to, I think, North Carolina, where a member of his family was or something. So I never knew him. I knew Professor Perlman. I came to Wisconsin to do graduate work because my professor at Maine, Kirshen, had worked with both Witte and Perlman, and maybe with Commons too, but to a lesser extent. And since I was interested in this field and also in land management, Wisconsin was very strong in land management, I came for that reason. When I arrived, expecting to be a teaching assistant in the large pool, Miss Bridgman, who was the secretary, said, "Well, Mr. Perlman wants to see you." And I said, "What for?" She said, "Well, go down and find out." She you know, to all intents and purposes, Miss Bridgman really managed the department, and she was an instructor and secretary. So I went down, and he asked me to be his assistant. Teaching assistant. He had gone through the files and discovered that I was from Maine. His wife came from New Hampshire. He liked New England, and he liked Yankees. Mm-hmm. He used to say, "We Jews and Yankees have a lot in common," which I thought was quite true, because I grew up in a household where the Jewish peddler was always welcomed, and he stayed overnight and was a friend of the family. My high school class was the best students and the leaders were Jewish kids, my close friends. And so, because we had kind of an affinity, which recognized, sometimes exaggerated a little, but it was there. And this turned out to be a little embarrassing 3 days later. Bill Knowles turned up, who'd been his assistant the year before, and accused me of taking his job away from him. I'd never heard of Bill Knowles. Mr. Perlman, for some reason, had decided Mr. Perlman wasn't very good at telling people he didn't want him around anymore, or he just wanted somebody else to handle that problem. But that began a marvelous intellectual experience for me. That first year, I was his teaching assistant in four large courses, only one of which I'd ever had before. I was not only the teaching assistant, but that was the fall that the GIs came back in great numbers. By January, I had four assistants of my own. I was managing the operation. And so then I went back to Maine at the end of the year.
So this is a one-year...
I had to support them in graduate school. I was married with a child, and I saved some money, but I didn't have enough to stay on and finish completely. At least we didn't want to live at that standard. I was on leave from university where I had teaching. So then, this is a bit of history which the department might be a little ashamed of, I think. They needed somebody to teach labor history particularly and to help with the load. So after a search, it was decided that the best person in the country was Philip Taft, who had been a student with Perlman and collaborated with Perlman on Volume 4 of the Commons History. Well, the version that I heard, again, some of this is hearsay. Remember, I was very junior around this place. That when they were discussing bringing Taft, they discussed his salary, and Professor Morton complained that they would bring this guy from Brown, whom he knew quite well, at a higher salary than Morton was getting. Well, this apparently got back to Taft, and he has a short fuse, Phil Taft did. He was a tremendous worker and scholar, but none of us are perfect. Anyway, he said, to hell with him, I'll stay right here, because he had mixed feelings. He had an ambivalent feeling about Mr. Perlman. In many ways he liked him, other ways he was very critical of him. He couldn't quite make up his mind. He'd worked like a demon when he was here on that book, you know. But then Mr. Perlman, he wasn't a great writer, but Perlman would rewrite it, the stuff, and kind of thing. Well, anyway, maybe I'm telling you more than I should put on this tape. But anyway, then, this is what part that we should be ashamed of. They decided, since they couldn't get somebody who knew something, let's get somebody who doesn't know anything and train him ourselves. So I was offered a position. Mm-hmm. Come back. I hadn't had my prelims yet. On the condition that I could be an instructor, work on my graduate work, and if I got my PhD, I would have a term as assistant professor, and then I would have to make my way. Well, in all those years, I worked with Mr. Perlman very closely. Mm-hmm. And of course, with Mr. Witte, too, and when Bob Fleming was here, we were very good friends, so I knew all these people. Reed Tripp was recruited, I think, by Mr. Witte, and he came as a professor, a full professor. He'd been teaching elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I might add, when the School for Workers was blowing up in 1950, Mr. Perlman, Mr. Witte, and Bob Fleming insisted that I go over and be the director. All my friends said, well, that's the end of your career there. Nobody's going to ever get out of that morass. That's extension activity and so on. I went over on a half-time basis. I taught half-time, did that for 2 years and got it. The fellow who should have had the job took me around and introduced me to people, and his introduction was always, this is Ed Young, there's nothing wrong with him except he just doesn't know anything about the subject. But that's when I made friends with the whole Wisconsin labor movement, those years as director of school workers. I wasn't a trade unionist. I didn't pretend to be, but and so that became useful in the when we got into the industrial relations business, because I had all the labor contacts and support that kept that up. The labor people thought very highly of Mr. Perlman, particularly, and so and then through the School for Workers, I was able to recruit Jack Barbash and help recruit him here. And I got Jim Stearns, even though by using the partly School for Workers money and departmental money, and then they evolved. Well, it was a great time to be an operator.
Mm-hmm. A lot of money, a lot of good people.
Well, yes, a lot of good people and some money.
I guess I wanted to talk a little bit more about the separation or the establishment of the center. I know that you were not director at the time, but I've sort of heard through hearsay, you know, and just from, I guess, just people's experience that was a quite a painful separation in some ways, as you described briefly earlier.
Well, you mean having courses? The separation, it really never came wholly. It was a gradual thing moving over. Now, the decision to give a graduate program was made in 55, 56 when I wasn't around. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that was too painful. Later on, we debated whether giving it a departmental status. That was quite a long, dragged-out debate, and finally came down on the side of staying with the department, but very closely. The economists argued that they didn't want to lose their department connection as economists, you see. I think Bob Lampman was the one who felt strongest about this, that the center, if the center became a separate department, there would be no labor people, only the Chicago types left in the department. And Chicago labor person sometimes is viewed as another commodity dealer. It isn't always true, you know. Actually, Glenn Kane's a splendid person. I think he's Chicago, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When the center was first set up, besides the Department of Economics and the School of Commerce at the time, what were some of the other parties involved?
I don't know when they first set it up whether the School of Commerce was in it at all. They were invited. Law school was very important. Nate Feinsinger was very important. Abner Brody was in the law school too. The law school had a tradition of interest in labor matters. Lloyd Garrison had been here, and he'd been big in government as well. He was the dean for a while here before the war, and so probably Nate Feinsinger was as important as anybody, and Nate had very, very strong connections with management and labor because of his role in the War Labor Board and as an arbitrator. Mr. Whitty had been with the War Labor Board also, and he'd been the chairman in Detroit, of the Detroit Board, and then he'd gone to Washington. If you want to know about that, my secretary went with him to those places. But it's only some of these things she may remember better than I do. She was a departmental secretary or second in command, or she worked for Miss Bridgman, then went off with Mr. Whitty when he needed a secretary to go to in Detroit and then to Washington. I guess when he went to Washington, she came back to Madison. But My advice would be for you to get on the phone with Bob Fleming, ask him what's a good time to talk for half an hour. He can tell you a great deal more. See, I wasn't even... Probably the center was established when I was the year I was in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so I was not really very active in it. When I came back because of my teaching, I worked with Bob some programs. But then when he left, I sort of there were ongoing things, and I carried them along.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, my concern was primarily the department. It may be for a while I was both the director of School for Workers and the center, and then the department and the center. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed when I was looking through a biography that there is some overlap in it because it doesn't break it down by months. It's unclear how much of it.
Well, usually I had at least two hats most of the time. Yes. Then, to come back to your question, quite early on, I don't know the date, Professor K.U. Smith of psychology became involved. He had been in industry in some role before he came as an older person to psychology department, and he had done work on time and motion study, proved quite to his own satisfaction it wasn't very scientific, which... let's see, who else were... did you remember any of the names that you saw?
Most of the people you mentioned, I think.
Yes, I think, yes. Elizabeth Brandeis would have been involved. I don't think Les Cohere was very much involved.
Was Elizabeth Brandeis also the one of Perlman's
yes,
she'd been
yes, and her husband, Paul Rauschenbusch, who ran the unemployment compensation for so many years, was a student of Commons. Paul, when the unemployment law was passed, he became active. Was active in promoting it. Professor Groves took leave and went to the legislature and pushed the unemployment compensation law. Wisconsin got the first one by a day or two or something, but it was along lines that Commons had laid down 10, 15 years before. So then Paul got involved with that and he became the administrator, never finished his degree. But Elizabeth did get her PhD, and she was a very good teacher in the department. She was the first person to really get excited about the migrant workers that I ever knew around here. And I raised some money from somewhere so that she could have an assistant who did work in that field. And she was quite a wonderful woman. Her son is in the law school, Walter Rauschenbusch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would say she was cooperative and supportive in the Industrial Relations Center or Institute. The name changes sometimes, I think you discover.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But she wasn't the leader in it. The leaders were Feinsinger and Witte, and first the Fleming, then later on Tripp, then Jerry Summers, and of course Jim Stern later. Bob Lampman, when he came to join the faculty, was always part of it, but not that wasn't his center of his interest.
Mm-hmm.
Have you talked with him?
I have very briefly. He's writing a history of the economics department.
Yes.
And I have a sort of tentative plans, though no date, to interview him later.
Have you been to the archives at all?
The university archives?
Yes. I was asking you about the archives.
That's right.
Have you been to them?
Yeah. I spent just a few hours there so far, but it seems like that it's,
they weren't designed for historians.
No, they were not. It's going to be hit or miss, I think.
Yes.
I know you said that you were, you know, quite involved with wearing your other hats. I wondered if you remembered some of the important considerations or concerns that you had as when you were director of IRC, and that would, and also what sort of a current events, so to speak, within the university and the larger social and political environment.
One of the programs that Bob Fleming got started was a program under which I believe it was AID, at least the State Department, the government, supported bringing young labor management people from France and Germany in groups here. And that took quite a lot of attention, time, damnation, for one thing, it meant some employment for graduate students as well as other things, and gave people a chance to get around. It's miserable.
I guess you were talking about the foreign scholar program, or the foreign graduate student program.
German French students were brought, and so that took some doing, and that was one of the principal activities in the year. Last year that Bob was here, and in the year or two after he left. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I don't remember a great deal about it. And I think, let's see, I don't know if my secretary was keeping a diary then or not. In the more recent times, she kept a diary of her own, and she provided me with dates and things. But I really, we may have had a conference or two, but it was a very low-key activity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sort of regrouping time.
Mm-hmm. What was the funding situation for the center at that time? Were you were part of the president's office, is that right? And was most of your support, therefore, from that office, or was it from special project grants? Do you remember that sort of thing?
Well, some of it was special grants. For instance, the foreign students were supported with overhead. We had overhead money from that, and support for that from them. And we had individual grants. Bob got some individual grants for some studies. And then there was some from the president's office, and I don't know when the budget shifted to the dean of letters and science, but mm-hmm. that wouldn't have made much difference, but the budget was shifted. In general, the practice has been to move things out of the president's office to a college whenever it's possible, so that would have been a normal operating procedure. Having it in the president's office in the first place was a little unusual, if anything. But
what do you think was the reason for the original reason for putting it in under the auspices of the president's office as opposed to a college?
Well, because it was supposed to be interdisciplinary and across campus lines, you see, and across college lines, as it was. Even if commerce didn't come in, there were law school people, and occasionally somebody from engineering was involved. And so that would be the reason for doing it that way. And it may have been also that it was a way of getting the money probably in between budget times. You see, the president would have had his, able to get some spare money from somewhere easier than a dean would. Deans don't like to give up money for somebody else's projects. They're very reluctant. But I don't really know. Now, if that's an important question, well, even if it isn't, the man who knows a great was great deal about this period, which we haven't mentioned, is Professor Ira Baldwin. He's retired. He was vice president of the university under Mr. Fred. He has an office in Van Nuys. He comes in almost every morning. I don't think he's 90 yet.
Mm-hmm.
His mind is as clear as in most of the freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
He knows a lot more.
Yeah.
But he's one of those people almost ageless, and he was Mr. Fred's right-hand man. And he would know, he could tell you some of the, you want to spice up your story a little, some of the politicking in the regions about this, because some of the regions were very conservative too. Things that I didn't know about. At the stage, you see, the first year I wasn't here, and the first year I came back, I was taking a full graduate load, teaching 12 hours a week. That kept me busy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the School for Workers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of this that I didn't pay much attention to.
Mm-hmm. What was your reasons, if you want to go into it, for leaving the center?
Whose reasons?
Your reasons for leaving the rectorship, if you'd like to go into that.
Oh, I left it because I went to Europe, you see.
Uh-huh.
And I was rebuilding an economics department. That was a much more important task.
Uh-huh.
For me, no, it wasn't any antipathy to it. And furthermore, Professor Tripp was really devoted to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had lots of other things to do.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't... there was no... I just didn't... I had priorities. My priority was the department.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? That was a very hectic period in the history of the economics department. That's when we brought in people like Guy Orchard and great numbers of people, Pete Steiner,
mm-hmm.
and other people were retiring, and mm-hmm. I was the youngest tenured member, and I was the chairman, and that wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm. What was your... I guess I'd like to move on to your contact with the Institute.
Yes.
After the directorship. I read recently that you were on a steering committee that was formed in 1956 and its mission, at least according to what I read, is to correct the so-called weaknesses of the original program. I wondered what your role was in that, and your impressions in terms of when they started to grant degrees, what their motivations were in terms of training people for jobs in academia or for going right into the labor movement or in business.
My role would have been after I came back from overseas in 56 and resumed the chairmanship of the department, would have been somebody teaching courses in the field, teaching labor history or labor problems or something like that. So I was a teaching member. I was teaching courses that their students took sometimes, occasionally helping with somebody's thesis or something. But I wasn't way out front. Sometimes I played a political role in the sense that within the university I ran a little interference, because I had maybe a little more influence in some places than some other people, because I was chairman of the economics department, you see. Trying to think back what my attitudes were, I would have been always plumping for the economic content of the industrial relations, you see. And so on. but I wouldn't have been alone in that. But I was more concerned about economics than Mr. Witte or Mr. or Reed Tripp were. They were concerned about labor negotiations and such things. Mm-hmm. So, but it was only a matter of mild differences, nothing. One of the things I was concerned about is that the degrees be have quite a lot of substance to them. That a person not get a degree by working with one person really almost exclusively and doing research and classes under and then writing a thesis under the same person. That question did come up once or twice, but there was no disagreement among the majority of us. It was a question of how do you go about enforcing it. You know, enforcing behavior on the part of faculty members isn't easy if they. So, but that was a minor problem.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as I say, my main attention was devoted, and my philosophical position hasn't changed any. That I don't believe anybody should be in labor management relations without sound grounding in economics.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more important than, and then secondary law is very important. I would have said that psychology was less important. Now there are some outstanding people in psychology in the industrial relations field, but
mm-hmm.
that by and large, our psychology department, you know, was a experimental psychology department, and that's where its strength was in those days. That they weren't as interested. The bulk of the department wasn't very interested in industrial relations.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memorable students that came through the program after it began to grant degrees that stick out in your mind?
Let's see. When were the first degrees granted?
57 academic
year. No, I don't. I would, you know, if I knew the names, some of them have gone on, done extraordinarily well. But I would see, if they were my graduate students, they would have been in economics primarily.
Mm.
See, I pushed my students into economics if I were working with them. If I were their major advisor,
mm-hmm.
My prejudice for economics, as it wasn't. Because it was broader then than it is now, because there were quite a few of us teaching labor courses in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would have been my role. I behaved about the same way Bob Lamb has been behaving. You know, he's interested, supportive, but he's an economist at heart,
mm-hmm.
even though the purists in the department wouldn't regard either of us as really very good economists. Me, much less than Bob.
Can you speak to the, this is specifically about the economics department, can you speak to the schism between labor economists and the so-called other specialties within economics? I'm not very familiar with that, but I've...
Well, I don't think there was ever a schism exactly between labor people and non-labor people. There was a shifting emphasis. It'd been the emphasis in the recruitment on getting labor people had changed, and as we got more theoretical people, when we were recruiting labor people, they wanted to get them more in their mold, you see. They would regard maybe Glenn Kane as a borderline case, whereas we would think of him as pretty far over in their area. It's that kind of thing. But I never, you know, after all, they made me chairman, and I was chairman 9 years, and so if there'd been a split, you know, a serious one, the bulk of I would have been voted out.
Mm-hmm.
That election took place every year.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't, I had, now, but then of course you have to get the dates of when Witte retired and Perelman retired. That reduced the labor's influence. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Professor Tripp was highly regarded by some of the non-labor people. I think it was partly personality. I liked him very much. If he were talking to you, he's very interesting. If he's lecturing to a class, he's very dull. Mm. But his interests were different from there. And somehow, now why would I think that? Well, when he got an offer, there was no attempt to keep him. You see, that's the test, you know, in the academic circles. You discover how the department feels about people is when they put an offer on the table.
Mm-hmm. How hard they fight, huh?
You know, yes, and mm-hmm. And that can be very disheartening to some people. Yeah.
This is going back to the communist accusation by the director of the School of Commerce. I wondered and I may be speaking sort of generally to the Department of Economics and the center, but whether your connection with the center or the Department of Economics involvement with the center caused any problems in the 50s in terms of McCarthyism, in terms of any kind of loyalty oath activity or...
No. First place, I would assume that when Mr. Elwell said those communists, he didn't mean card...
I may be speaking sort of generally to the Department of Economics and the center, but whether your connection with the center or the Department of Economics involvement with the center caused any problems in the 50s in terms of McCarthyism, in terms of any kind of loyalty oath activity or...
No. First place, I would assume that when Mr. Elwell said those communists, he didn't mean card-carrying members. He meant people who were left. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and being left to Mr. Elwell, there couldn't be any other place. No, our department, to my knowledge, never had any faculty members who were even close to being communists. They'd been liberal for a long time. They were always in the forefront of labor reform and working with unions, all that, but many of the people. But, no, in fact, no, but there were students in the... We had graduate students. I remember graduate student coming in my office and saying, well, something's going to happen. They're burning... I saw at my back window that so-and-so and two or three others are burning all their documents. Mm-hmm. That's when the word came from the party for them to pull out. They dropped out of school right in the middle of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that, the university itself, to my knowledge, was never attacked by McCarthy. He came here occasionally to speak, not very often. The students gave him a hard time, but we had no problem. We had no witch hunts. So many people, of course, don't know the difference between a communist and somebody who's a Marxist or just doesn't agree with them, but I think we were, in part, we were fortunate because we'd been so liberal and had all kinds of people, and we knew the difference. Mm-hmm. We knew the difference between somebody who's following the Stalinist party line. After all, I was teaching capitalism and socialism, and I probably knew more about their literature than most of the kids who thought they were communists.
Mm-hmm.
See, my theory about most of the kids who think they're communists when they're on the campus is that when they if you keep them out of jail, they'll become advertising executives. Eventually. Not always. Some of them go on, but most of them don't, you know. It's a growing up place. And they ought to flirt with ideas, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
My job was to try to protect them. It wasn't a problem. In the campus, apparently, and I don't know exactly what happened, but at that period, the party line was very tight, you know, the control. The word came to all the universities, pull out for whatever purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of the students coming back, the one who seemed to be the leader here, and saying to me, you call off the FBI, will you? I said, what are you talking about? He says, they keep coming around and asking me questions about who some other members of the party are, and I refuse to tell them, but they keep bothering me. And he said, you can stop them. I said, well, look, they don't work for me, and I can't stop them. I said, you know, you've got yourself into this, and you've got to get yourself out of it. I can't do it for you. And, of course, then the war came, and, this, you know, many of the people who have been party liners, but when this treaty between Hitler and Stalin was signed, that turned off a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't unfashionable in the late 30s around here, from what people tell me, for people to be active in, if not being card-carrying members, to be in cells and things. That was going on all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there any other political events, or either locally within Wisconsin or nationally, that you felt had a large influence on the workings of the institute? I guess it was at the time, or on the Department of Economics.
No, I don't think so. I you know, as I say, we had no witch hunt. We had one member of the department we recruited who had been at least looked upon with suspicion when he was an officer in Japan, but I never took that very seriously, because he was kind of a guy who, you know, if you said you were from the FBI, he'd say, oh, you guys bothering us communists again, when he wasn't a communist. No, that he just couldn't resist that kind of thing. So, but no, and I just, it is interesting that this group, which we're regarded, you know, kind of, we still have a reputation of being a leftist university around the country. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not. It's nonsense, because see, they don't understand the difference between being for progressive legislation. Not, that isn't such a big shot, a big thing on, but the Commons and Garris, Lloyd Garrison, and people who want to make reform on employment commons, some people regard that as pretty outrageous. That's where we got the reputation. Then we did attract a lot of liberal and some radical students, because one of the people sometimes ask me, why did Wisconsin, in this relatively poor state, get such preeminence? And well, lots of it was luck, but one of the things was that when other schools had quotas on people from New York, New Jersey, where they didn't have good public schools in those days, Wisconsin was always open to them. And so we got a brilliant group of alumni, and some of them were a little farther left than some others. And a few of them, of course, later turned out to be involved in things, but no more than anywhere else, I think. Better, because, as I say, Perlman was here, and he was a very good teacher of what Marxism is about, because he'd been a Marxist himself.
Mm-hmm. What is your... I don't know how familiar you are with the Institute these days, in terms of what it's teaching and what its research activities are, and whether you have an opinion as to the strengths and the weaknesses of the program as it's presently constituted.
Oh, I have a very high regard. I have a very high regard for it. I'm very proud that it's here. Some of the people that we give degrees to and are doing excellent work all over the country. It's easier to if you have a degree in industrial relations to get a job than it is if you have it in economics. And I worry a little with Jim Stearns retiring and Jerry Summers gone, but we're in the process of recruiting some young people, and the department has just given tenure to Ruth, yes, and that's a good sign, because she's good, and it also means that they're not entirely averse to labor issues.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't get it because she was a woman. I went to that meeting. I usually stay away from all this stuff, but that was one that I was interested in. to get. I was impressed at the presentation. Lee Hansen. Lee is a thorough worker. Gosh, he's so thorough and organized in a way that I never was. And mm-hmm. I admire him for it. Mm-hmm. And he's a good scholar, too. So I don't know everybody that's involved, but I think it's going fine. It's attracting good students. Mm-hmm. So, no, I'm proud that... I'm proud of it, but I'm careful not to take too much credit, which I don't deserve. Other people have done it. I didn't do it. By 1960, I was out of all this. I went to Pakistan and came back as dean. Mm-hmm. So I saw it only as one more administrative unit, and a very small one at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you see as the future of industrial relations study, just generally? Do you see it going in any particular direction? Do you see it, for instance, the ideas that I think are floating around to subsume it within the School of Business, whether you could comment on that, and also where you'd like to see it go, you know, in addition to where you see it going?
I wouldn't like to see it go into the School of Business, but if the college and the department don't give it support, it may have to do that, because it's very difficult for a small unit in a large university to stand out. It's got to have somebody to help fight for its budget and protect it in a larger pool of resources. There are some very good programs that are in business schools. 15 years ago, I would have fought it very hard, but the business school has changed a great deal. But I don't think it's necessary, and I would rather it wouldn't. I think the future programs are... it's pretty well established. It's going to be study of what's going on in collective bargaining and labor law, and in what's happening to workers, and affirmative action problems will be big for a while, but then they'll fade away and become less important, because once it's just taken for granted that women are entitled to equal treatment, and that will come. It's coming fast. The minority problem is a different problem, and I despair about that one. That's so tough. There'll be some of that in industrial relations, but the mainstream will be dealing with management, labor relations, and labor law, and train. Some people will go to the government. The labor department is not going to disappear, and wages are not going to go out of business. So these are fundamental issues. It's neat. And another area which will expand, I think, constantly is the area of arbitration. There are areas where labor management can't afford to have strikes. That is, I'm saying, maybe can't. I'd be against laws to forbid them, but see what is happening to United Airlines. They beat the pilots, but it's going to destroy, the company is going to be gone as it was. Cudahy is going down the drain because of the labor dispute. And so the thoughtful people on both sides are very concerned that how do we find some way. Politically, it's hard for the labor leaders because they have to run for election and so on, as you must know. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, in the telephone, the telephone company can run for months without the telephone workers. Mm-hmm. Another world. The only place that labor is gaining strength is in the public employment because of the political pressure they can put on the legislature. Mm-hmm. And so there's got to be some ways. But, labor isn't going to turn over and play dead. It's going to be strong. Mm-hmm. It'll be different. Mm-hmm. So there's lots to... There's lots to study and a lot of need for well-trained people. Who knows the economics, knows the law, and you know, just don't go in and demand a great deal and see what you can get. Bargaining has changed, negotiations, arbitration, all these things. So there's a role. We'll always need university presidents. You know, a great many of us, Bob Fleming, Clark Kerr, Bach at Harvard, you know, the name went around, probably Buck, Bucklew, who was one of our students, by the way, in industrial relations, who was president of West Virginia, who was having a little difficulty there, but everybody in West Virginia is having difficulty.
Secretary of State, too.
What?
You also need Secretary of State.
Yes. What they consider very soft discipline, you know, that doesn't have the rigor of econometrics or chemistry, get into these situations. Well, I think it's part because we have learned to deal with things that are not certain, and we've learned that also that there are likely to be two sides to most questions, and the simple answers just aren't there, and we to live with that. You see, when you can't have certainty. I think that may be it. I don't know. Maybe it's because we get tired of what we're doing. now, before we stop, I want to suggest again. Now, Reed Tripp can be reached by phone. I had a long phone conversation with him not too long ago. He's retired from the university. He was dean at Lehigh, and now he's retired, but he's carrying on an active arbitration business. He has his own. He has an office for that in Philadelphia.
And that's what the number is, I see. Because I have a number for him in Philadelphia. I was wondering what.
Yes. Well, there's two. He lives just outside of Philadelphia, but his office number. And then Ira Baldwin, you can get by calling him. Tell him because I suggested you talk with him. I don't think you'd have any trouble anyway because he's very generous, but that would make it might make it a little easier. And Bob Fleming, these are all easy. Bob may be coming here, but he's coming sometime. I can't remember when, but sometimes it's easier to get him on the telephone than it is to. And if you use the university phones, it doesn't cost much, you know, with the Watts line. No problem about that. You want me to give you his number?
Bob Flint, I think I have his number. The department has his number.
Okay. He's in Ann Arbor. Let's see. Who else would there? Then, of course, you have access to the people in the department. There's nobody in the dean's office who knows anything about it. Nobody in the chancellor's office who knows anything. Beyond what the dean knows, the question of whether there should be a department or not, and budgeting question, but he wouldn't know much beyond that, I guess. So that's the situation. And I wish I could be more helpful, but you see, it wasn't something that was grabbing all my time. I was doing a job, but it was always a secondary one.